The Bible reading this morning comes from 2 Kings, chapter 23, verses 36, through to chapter 24, verse 17, and it's found inside the leaflet you received. Jehoiakim was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned for 11 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zebadah, the daughter of Pedaiah, of Rumah. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his fathers had done. In his days, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his servant for 3 years. Then he turned and rebelled against him, and the Lord sent against him bands of the Chaldeans, and bands of the Syrians, and bands of the Moabites, and bands of the Ammonites, and sent them against Judah to destroy it, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke by his servants the prophets. Surely this came upon Judah at the command of the Lord to remove them out of his sight for the sins of Manasseh according to all that he had done, and also for the innocent blood that he had shed. For he filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, and the Lord would not pardon. Now the rest of the deeds of Jehoiakim and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? So Jehoiakim slept with his fathers, and Jehoiachin his son reigned in his place. And the king of Egypt did not come again out of his land, for the king of Babylon had taken all that belonged to the king of Egypt, from the brook of Egypt to the river Euphrates. Jehoiachin was 18 years old when he became king, and he reigned 3 months in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Nehushta, the daughter of Elnathan of Jerusalem. And he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his fathers had done. At that time, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up to Jerusalem, and the city was besieged. And Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to the city while his servants were besieging it. And Jehoiachin, the king of Judah, gave himself up to the king of Babylon, himself and his mother and his servants and his officials and his palace officials. The king of Babylon took him prisoner in the 8th year of his reign, and carried off all the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king's house, and cut in pieces all the vessels of gold in the temple of the Lord, which Solomon, king of Israel, had made, as the Lord had foretold. He carried away all Jerusalem, and all the officials, and all the mighty men of valor, 10,000 captives, and all the craftsmen and the smiths. None remained, except the poorest people of the land. And he carried away Jehoiachin to Babylon, the king's mother, the king's wives, his officials, and the chief men of the land he took into captivity from Jerusalem to Babylon. And the king of Babylon brought captive to Babylon all the men of valor, 7,000, and the craftsmen and the metal workers, 1,000. All of them strong and fit for war. And the king of Babylon made Mattaniah, Jehoiachin's uncle, king in his place, and changed his name to Zedekiah.
Thanks, Noel. There's a funny thing going on here. We know that Jerusalem is the great city of the ancient Israelites. Right here, down in verse 36, the place where the kings reigned. Down in verse 12, it's the place where they had their great temple. We know in the New Testament that Jerusalem, it's the place where Jesus went. It's the place where Jesus was crucified. It's the place where his tomb was. It's where his disciples met him again after he was raised back to life. Big deal in the Bible, city of Jerusalem. And with all of that, you can see why everyone wants a piece of modern Jerusalem. But if Jerusalem is the big Bible place. Why is so much of the Bible down there in verse 1 with Babylon? Why is Babylon such a big deal in the story? You think about it. The Old Testament, as we have it in English, 39 books in the Old Testament, 929 chapters. How many of those chapters in the Old Testament were written in the great Bible city of Jerusalem? Around 400. How many were written in Babylon? At least 300, probably more. And if you're worried that it doesn't add up, there were a number written in other places too, so feel the numbers. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, comes into 9 different books of the Old Testament, more than any other king except David and Solomon. And Genesis, Job, the Psalms, Isaiah, Ezekiel, all those parts of the Bible take big Babylonian ideas and explore them and take them apart as though that is something that is really important to do. Sorting out Israel's history and understanding it, organising Israel's poetry, thinking about how to live for God in a different kind of world, all that happens in Babylon. And although the city of Babylon lasts for around 2,000 years in ancient times, this version of Babylon, the one where all this action happens, only goes for 66 years. But so many big Bible things are squeezed into that 66 years. So why? Why Babylon? We need to understand that if we're going to make sense of our Bible. And we need to understand it right now if we're going to make sense of the great prophet Ezekiel. Now we'll be looking at Ezekiel's book the next few weeks, and all the action in Ezekiel is around people being in Babylon. So for old Ezekiel, our first puzzle is, what is going on with Babylon? And the answers are here in the book of 2 Kings. And we find them in this strange story of three brothers. Now take a look. Once, long ago in Jerusalem, in the 600s BC, there were three brothers, Shalom, Eliakim, and Mattaniah. And they almost certainly didn't look like that. But there were three brothers. They were in the royal family, and they lived in one of those times in history when everything is changing really quickly. And you have to be thinking and working all the time just to keep up with change. One of those moments in history when a bit of wisdom can do wonderful things. Their great-grandfather, the three brothers' great-grandfather, was bad King Manasseh, down there in verse 3. The sins of Manasseh according to all that he had done, and also for the innocent blood that he had shed, for he filled Jerusalem with innocent blood. Manasseh was king in Jerusalem for a long time, 55 years, from 696 BC down to 641 BC. He was king at a time when the Assyrians held everything around Jerusalem. And bad King Manasseh made Jerusalem a very Assyrian place with Assyrian gods in the temple and Assyrian ways of living and treating people. And the whole thing of being, the whole Old Testament thing of being a people special to God, that goes right out in Manasseh's time. So we get verse 3, the innocent blood that he had shed. Man, we have to be a bit careful. Down there in verse 3, we've got the idea of exile in Babylon at the command of the Lord, to remove them out of his sight for the sins of Manasseh. For he filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, which the Lord would not pardon. We want to be careful of thinking that Manasseh did all these bad things, and then the people got better. But 50 years later, God was still so angry that he punished a whole new generation of people for what bad King Manasseh did half a century ago. We want to be careful of thinking that way. We get a little bit of that grumble in the book of Ezekiel when the people are in Babylon and when they're saying, Ezekiel chapter 18,
the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. There's our fathers made the problem and now we're putting up with it.
Way back with Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 24, God taught the Israelites not to punish children for what their parents do. Okay, so God teaches them, don't punish children for what their parents do, don't punish parents for what their children do. But in Babylon, in Ezekiel's time, they're saying, it was our grandparents who did the wrong thing, and now we are being punished for it. How's that fair? Verse 3 here looks like it could be a bit of that, except that what verse 3 calls the sins of Manasseh are like what 1 Kings called the sins of Jeroboam. They're talking about something that is still going on generations later. People are still doing what Manasseh taught them. And when we look in Ezekiel, we see some very Manasseh things happening long after Manasseh's died. And these three brothers, Shalom, Eliakim, and Mattaniah, end up very Manasseh-ish in what they do. Mind, their three brothers, their father wasn't like that. Their father was good King Josiah. Good King Josiah, who reads the books of Moses and tries to turn things around. So we get 2 Kings saying of Josiah, before him there was no king like him who turned to the Lord with all his heart. And good King Josiah lives at another special time in history. In the middle 600s BC, from 640 to 609, he lives at the time when Assyria is going backwards, with strife back home in Assyria, and then with Babylon breaking loose and making its own kingdom, there's not much that Assyria can do to Jerusalem in Josiah's time. And without Assyria around, Josiah has a free hand to do lots of things. He tries to clean up Manasseh's mess, and he tries to bring the people back to what God taught them with Moses. And for a moment, things look different. But then Josiah falls to one of those random things that makes history. Assyria has been on the retreat since the 620s, with the armies of the Medes and Babylon hammering away at it. In 612 BC, the capital of Assyria falls, and the last Assyrian king retreats to the banks of the Euphrates. The king of Assyria calls on Egypt for help. You can imagine Pharaoh scratching his head over this. Egypt would much rather have a weak and crumbling kingdom of Assyria than have a strong and dangerous Babylon. So Pharaoh Necho II comes out with his army to help Assyria. Pharaoh joining up with Assyria and taking control, not something that Josiah wants. So, at this moment, only 13 years into his reforms, and without them having really taken hold, and without a succession plan, and without a big enough army, good King Josiah marches out to play global politics. It goes wrong. There is a plain in northern Palestine that is the best place for an army to travel through when they're going through Palestine. And overlooking that plain, there is the mighty fortress of Megiddo. So Josiah goes there to stop the Pharaoh from going through. And we get King Josiah went to meet him, and Pharaoh Necho killed him at Megiddo as soon as he saw him. And his servants carried him dead in a chariot from Megiddo and brought him to Jerusalem and buried him in his own tomb. Oh dear. And that's where our three brothers move in.
Shalom, Eliakim, and Mataniah. They are Josiah's sons. Shalom gets first go. He's not number one son, but he is the people's choice. And for being king, he changes his name to Jehoahaz. Yahweh has grasped. So we get 2 Kings 23. And the people of the land took Jehoahaz, son of Josiah, and anointed him and made him king in his father's place. But then we get Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he began to reign, and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his fathers had done. So he is no Josiah. Really, he lives in a house of straw. We get, and he reigned 3 months in Jerusalem. And then the next bit, and Pharaoh Necho put him in bonds at Riblah in the land of Hamath, that he might not reign in Jerusalem, and laid on the land a tribute of 100 talents of silver and 1 talent of gold, that is, lots of money. And he took Jehoahaz away, and he, that is Jehoahaz, came to Egypt and died there. Now you see what that means? Pharaoh Necho, he's the boss. Pharaoh Necho is so much in charge now in Palestine that he can kill one king, and he can cart the next one off as a prisoner, and he can demand money with menaces. The end starts here. Now, after Brother Shalom, then comes Brother Eliakim. And see what 2 Kings says. Verse 2 Kings 23, verse 34. Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim, the son of Josiah, king in the place of Josiah his father, and changed his name to Jehoiakim. And Jehoiakim gave the silver and the gold to Pharaoh, but he taxed the land to give the money according to the command of Pharaoh. Necho is making and breaking kings of Jerusalem. Necho is charging them tax. Necho is deciding what the king of Jerusalem is going to be called. Jehoiakim, Yahweh has raised up. So maybe more accurately you call him Nechoakim. Necho has put him on the throne. The kingdom of Judah has just become a vassal of Egypt. Sort of an appendage to the Pharaoh. And then 2 Kings tells us Jehoiakim was 25 years old. You see here in verse 36. Was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Now, evil in the sight of the Lord, what does that mean? Well, a couple of glimpses. Brother Shalom, we know, lived in a house of straw, and Necho blew it away. But Brother Jehoiakim, he lives in a house of sticks, quite literally. His job for Pharaoh, we know, his job was to raise tax for Pharaoh, to give Pharaoh the people's money. But what does he do with the rest of the tax that he gets from his tiny little kingdom? Now, Jeremiah, the prophet, is in Jerusalem at this time, and this is what he says about Jehoiakim. Woe to him who says, I will build myself a great house with spacious upper rooms and cut out windows for it, panelling it with cedar and painting it with vermilion. Do you think you are a king because you compete in cedar? You have eyes and heart only for your dishonest gain, for shedding innocent blood, and for practicing oppression and violence. Brother Jehoiakim, now that he's king, thinks that he is the new Solomon. So he builds himself a cedar palace, and he puts the people to forced labour. Or another bit of Jehoiakim, Jeremiah chapter 36. Now, in this part, it is 603 BC. It's halfway through Jehoiakim's time as king. And God gets Jeremiah the prophet to write some of his prophecies down. And God says, Jeremiah 36, it may be that everyone may turn from his evil way
and that I may forgive their iniquity and their sin. This is what God wants to do. So Jeremiah's prophecies get written down and read out loud in the temple in Jerusalem. And the news that this is happening gets to the top people. So they take the book that's got Jeremiah's words in it, and they take it to Brother Jehoiakim. And we get, the king was sitting in the winter house, and there was a fire burning before him. You can see what's going to happen, can't you? As Yehudi read three or four columns, the king would cut them off with a knife and throw them into the fire until the whole scroll was consumed. And then we get, yet neither the king nor any of his servants who heard these words was afraid, nor did they tear their garments. Even when Elnathan and Deliah and Gemariah urged the king not to burn the scroll, he would not listen to them. This is a very long way from the kind of king that Moses talked about, who would pay careful attention to what God says and keep God's books with him day and night. But then see how things go for Jehoiakim. 605 BC, Babylon and Egypt fight a great battle on the banks of the Euphrates. It's one of those hinge points in history. Jeremiah describes it in chapter 46 with the horses and the armor and the panic of the soldiers. And in the battle, Babylon wins. And General Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon becomes King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. Necho has to get out of Syria and Palestine very quickly. So we get verse 1 here. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his servant. So put there by Pharaoh, now he becomes Nebuchadnezzar's servant. Very quickly he changes sides. And that is the same moment that we get in the beginning of the book of Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with some of the vessels of the house of God. Then the king commanded his chief eunuch to bring some of the royal family, that is, King Nebuchadnezzar commanded, to bring some of the royal family and the nobility, and to teach them the letters and language of the Chaldeans. So Jehoiakim becomes Nebuchadnezzar's man, and Nebuchadnezzar takes hostages and takes them away to Babylon to keep it that way. 601 BC, Nebuchadnezzar fights the Pharaoh again down on the Egyptian border. And Nebuchadnezzar loses, but goes away to rebuild his army. But the Pharaoh hardly wins. So we get verse 7 here. And the king of Egypt did not again come out of his land, for the king of Babylon had taken all that belonged to the king of Egypt, from the brook of Egypt to the river Euphrates. So it's all Babylonian now. And King Jehoiakim, though, he makes this his moment for verse 1. Then he turned and rebelled against him. That is, the king of Babylon has just captured all this territory, so Jehoiakim rebels against the king of Babylon. And in verse 2, that brings war and siege and destruction. First in verse 2, with bands of mercenaries attacking Jerusalem. Then in verse 10, Nebuchadnezzar comes back with a new army and starts laying siege to Jerusalem. Thank you very much, Jehoiakim. Now watch out for something here. Two Kings here tells us the story. But Two Kings very rarely tells us what we ought to make of the story. Just sort of lays it out for us. Two Kings assumes that we already know how to work that out from other parts of the Bible. So there are just occasional moments in the book of 2 Kings when it makes comments like, he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And we can say, okay, that was obviously a bad thing.
But most of the time, 2 Kings just tells us the story. There is a load more going on, and here in brother Jehoiakim, at the last moment of the kingdom of Judah, there is something that we ought to recognize, because the book of Proverbs in the Bible has warned us about it. Think of the things in the book of Proverbs. Think of the things that the book of Proverbs tells us about that are symptoms of the fool. You know, Proverbs has a lot to say about being foolish. Think of the things that Proverbs says are symptoms of the fool and see whether or not they apply to Jehoiakim. He leaves God out of the picture. Yes. He will not listen to good wisdom. Yes. He repeats his stupidity, as the book of Proverbs says, in the same way that a dog goes back to its own vomit. Oh dear. Yes. He thinks he's terribly clever. Yes. He fails to grasp how his behaviour affects the people around him, or else he doesn't care. Yes. Now, the book of Proverbs just describes all those things, but 2 Kings gives it to us in the flesh to see it all happening and understand what it's like when it happens, when someone is really foolish. In the moment in their history when the people of Judah needed wisdom, they needed wisdom really urgently, they get a king who's a fool. Maximum stupid. And watch out for this. The Bible, especially the book of Proverbs, has a lot to say about stupidity and being humble enough to avoid it. But in our circles, at our own time in history, we're often in danger of being much too indulgent to stupidity, as though it's something Christian. You know, indulging stupidity is not a classical part of Christian thinking. It is something fairly new, thinking that it's okay to be stupid. There are reasons why in our kind of circles we might think that it's okay to be stupid, and if we want, we can trace the history and development of a bunch of things that grow out of America at the end of the 1800s, and we can look at the way that Christian believers in our own time use 1 Corinthians chapter 1 to say they are avoiding the wisdom of this world, when in reality they are being lazy and ignorant. You know, we might pretend that it's terribly godly, that we are simple people, and that thinking is all terribly contaminated, wicked stuff, so we shouldn't touch it. So stay stupid and ignorant, and call it godliness. But in the book of Proverbs, in our Bible, stupidity damages everyone nearby. And in our own time and place, we can't afford it any more than the kingdom of Jerusalem could afford it. So, let's see Jehoiakim. Watch and learn. Here are some massive pieces of stupid, and see it crash. Well, we see it crash, but Jehoiakim doesn't. Verse 6. In the middle of his rebellion against Babylon, Jehoiakim suddenly dies. And in verse 6, he leaves the whole mess for his son to clean up. So in verse 8, his son Jehoiachin becomes king. Now, I think we don't often notice because their names are so much the same, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin. But Jehoiachin really does not last long. Verse 9 tells us that he is another one who does evil. But on the stupidity side, he's about 500 times smarter than his dad was. So, in verse 12, within 3 months of starting as king, Jehoiachin does the one act of his reign, and he does something smarter than anything his father ever did. Jehoiachin, king of Judah, gave himself up to the king of Babylon. It's smart because he lives, and his children live. And in verse 12, Nebuchadnezzar takes him prisoner. And then in verse 14, Nebuchadnezzar rounds up the top
people, in Jehoiachin's army. In verse 16, he takes a crowd of the regular soldiers. In verse 16, there are the craftsmen and the metal workers, that is, the people who make the swords and the armour and things. In verse 15, there are the royal family and the chief men of the land. Thousands of people are taken off to Babylon. 597 BC. Well, February the 16th, 597 BC. We know because Nebuchadnezzar talks about it on a clay tablet in the British Museum and gives us his version of all of these events. But it's still not over. When the king and all those people get taken away, Jerusalem still stands. And there are still people living there. In verse 17, there's even a king. Shalom and Eliakim had one more brother, their youngest brother. He was only 9 when his father died, brother Mattaniah. And with one last go for the kingdom of Judah, 597 BC, Nebuchadnezzar takes him and puts him in as king and calls him Zedekiah. Yahweh is righteous. And now we enter a really weird time. The exile started back in 605 BC when the first hostages, Daniel and that, were taken off. But then it really started in 597 BC with Jehoiakim's war and Jehoiachin and all those people being taken off. But now, in 597 onwards, we've got a strange time where there are people from Judah in exile in Babylon, but Jerusalem still stands, and there are people living there too, with King Zedekiah. And we get these strange attitudes. So, over in Babylon, there are people from Judah who are saying, that's it, we're lost, it's all over for us. But those people that we left behind in Jerusalem, they're going to be okay. And there are weird prophets springing up in Babylon and saying, no, it's all okay for everyone. You will all be home back in Jerusalem in time for Christmas. And meanwhile, in Jerusalem, the people of Judah are saying, that's it. Those poor people who got taken off to Babylon, they are lost. Yeah? It's all over for them. But in Jerusalem, we are okay. And weird prophets are springing up in the city of Jerusalem saying, that's all okay. God is about to smash Babylon and the exiles, they will all be back here in time for Christmas. And in both places, there is a belief, there's an absolutely rock-solid belief that Jerusalem will stand. It has the temple. God will never let it fall. So in Jerusalem, God gives them Jeremiah the prophet, warning them to turn back before it's too late, and warning King Zedekiah especially. And in Babylon at the same time, God gives them Ezekiel the prophet, warning them that Jerusalem is not safe. It will fall, and the future is in exile. For the first 33 chapters of Ezekiel, Jerusalem still stands, and the people in exile with Ezekiel don't believe it can ever fall. And both Jeremiah and Ezekiel have the job of teaching the people the meaning of the exile as God's judgment on hundreds of years of rejecting him and treating each other like dirt. And it's with Jeremiah and Ezekiel that we have to make sense of this in the end. This sad tale of 3 brothers and 2 cities. And this is why so much of the Old Testament ends up being written in Babylon. And why Babylon looms like such a big thing over the Old Testament. It's in Babylon with Ezekiel, and with the help of Jeremiah, and later with Obadiah and the writers of Kings and Chronicles and the other Bible books. It's in Babylon that God will help them to make sense of this story and of their Old Testament experience. This Old Testament is the story of a people who lost their promised land. A people who had the promises of God and were saved by God and welcomed to be his own people, and then threw it all away and lost the promised land. In the same way that the man and the woman in Genesis lost the garden. It's the story of a human race that can't make it without God and his help and his grace. It's the story of a human race that needs a radical new start. And it takes Babylon and exile to understand that. And with that, when we look at these brothers and this exile, we ought to get that this Old Testament is an unfinished book. It's a problem without a solution. It's a question without the answer. And if that bothers us, it ought to drive us on to Ezekiel and to what he looks forward to the New Testament and to Jesus, to a man in the same family tree as these dreadful brothers. It was King Jehoiakim's great, 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 great 30 greats grandson, to the New Testament and to Jesus, with a completely different way of being human. And if we're unsatisfied with the Old Testament and its unfinished story, it ought to drive us on to the astonishing grace and mercy that God brings through Jesus to deal with this human mess. And that's where we're headed. That's where we go. From next week, we start to go there. From next week, we start to look at what God unfolds of his grace and mercy and forgiveness, even to this kind of human race. And we start to go there with Ezekiel the prophet as our guide.